From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Actor Anthony Mackie is really showing off his range lately, and in a moment, he'll join us to talk about his latest two roles, both very different kinds of heroes. And that gives us a chance to revisit a conversation we had on a recent show about superheroes and comic books. Last week, we talked about the unique way that illustrated stories offer powerful social and political commentary. We wondered if you read comics and if you take them seriously as literature. Here are your first thoughts. Ilya Smith says, when I was a student at Fort Valley State University, one of my English classes was analyzing comics. We read and studied Sandman, Swamp Thing. We studied many works of Neil Gaiman, a comic about death, Black Mist, Blood of Kali, etc. It was my favorite class. It's gotten me into comics, and I'm discovering a fascinating new world. We always love to hear what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter, at OST Talk, and the Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Actor Anthony Mackie is currently handing out justice at every major movie theater in the country. His role as the superhero Falcon in Captain America: Civil War is a big part of that film's success. His next role centers on a different brand of justice. Anthony Mackie plays the role of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. in the new biopic, All the Way.
I urge you to enact President Kennedy's civil rights bill into law.
It ain't gonna be easy, Dr. King.
This president is gonna have to deliver, and we're gonna hold his feet to the fire till he does.
That movie will premiere this Saturday on HBO, and Anthony Mackie joins me now. Hi there.
Hey, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. I wonder what difference you find in a script that's been adapted from a play, or if there is one, from a script that's maybe just been written for the screen, like, say, any of the Marvel films.
Well, you know, being a play, the emphasis is always on the dialogue. It's always on character. You would hope that every great script, every script that you enjoy, would have the same characteristics as far as story, plot, character. But that's not always the case. Plays are usually much more dense in verbiage. So it's you have to basically take it and take all those take all that stuff out and put in some visual stuff, some descriptions to help out the story moving along.
So I understand that you went and tapped into the archives at Morehouse to look into Martin Luther King Jr.'s background. And I wonder, what is that safe spot for you? What was the thing that you found or the thing that you learned that kind of opened up that character for you?
You know, it was his, ironically enough, it was his aggression. It was his eagerness to succeed with civil rights. The one thing about this movie that I loved so much when I read the script that I've never seen in a movie portraying Dr. King, he was a great politician, and he had the ability to negotiate and figure out how to get into circles and conversations with people that other people couldn't get into. And that was 100% because he had the ability of compromise. And, you know, living in the society that we live in, and, you know, compromise is the most offensive word in the English language right now. But Dr. King and LBJ mastered it in a way that they were able to get landmark opportunities passed in politics.
And I find it interesting that you're talking about the political side of Martin Luther King, because politics and diplomacy and compromise was something that LBJ has always been remembered for. So how did that work in your chemistry with Bryan Cranston? Did you find yourself actually having to sort of find a way around the character of LBJ or Bryan Cranston as an actor?
Not at all. You know, it's always say acting is a dangerous compromise. The interesting thing about it, you walk into a room with another actor and you never really know how they're going to respond. You never really know if they like to rehearse, if they know their line and what, in which way they work. So it's always at first a negotiation, you know, a feeling out of each other. And from that point, you can move on. But those first 2 days are pretty shaky. From the first moment I met Brian, I was impressed with his ability and his prowess as far as developing his character, and freedom with language and expression. And it's really interesting when looking at Dr. King and his relationship with LBJ. It was the same thing. I mean, they were truly Ali Frazier. you know, Dr. King had a lot invested in Kennedy. And at the point in the movie in 1963, you know, the civil rights movement was teetering. It was at a point of no return. It was all or nothing. And the nonviolent movement was starting to fall apart, basically. And it was the same thing with LBJ. Once Kennedy was assassinated, LBJ was so insecure about deserving to be the president that they had this thing where they knew they needed each other, but they didn't know how to go at it if they could trust each other. And Cranston and I, we really didn't know each other. So that uncomfortable nature between two actors, that inability to communicate, that learning, figuring each other out comes across in the scenes, but it works instead of just being stagnant.
You know, I wonder how you picked up the speech pattern. Now, you were born and raised in Louisiana. They're both Southern, but the Louisiana accent is very different than the Georgia accent. How did you study the speech patterns? And you know, Martin Luther King Jr. did have a trace of his Southern accent.
He did. Yeah, he did. And there were certain words that he would use where his accent would come out. But the thing that with Dr. King that was so important for me was, you know, he had this singing to his voice. He had this it was almost like a lilt. That was something I tried to capture, the stressing of words and almost like speaking in iambic pentameter in a way that it hearkened of Shakespeare. So it wasn't so difficult for me to do.
But the government can't legislate what people feel in their heart. And he's right. The law can't make white folks love them. But the law can prevent them from lynching you. The law can prevent them from denying you a job and your child an education. Now, the law can ensure that you have the right to vote.
Amen.
I wonder, what do we learn coming away from this movie that we haven't learned in previous movies that featured MLK or LBJ, for that matter?
That we're still living in an LBJ society. What was really remarkable in the 4 years that he, 4.5 years that he was president, he was able to do more and publish more, get more into law than I would say any president. You know, since the Emancipation Proclamation, everything after that, no one touched civil rights. LBJ was in office for 8 months before his reelection. And I would say the single greatest thing for America since the Emancipation Proclamation was the Civil Rights Act. And I think when you see that, how hard he worked for that, how he utilized every muscle he had in the Senate to push it through, it's extremely admirable. And the way he and Dr. King worked together, it was it was like a symphony. It was beautiful. It was beautiful to see. It was beautiful to see, considering our government today, we can't even elect a Supreme Court justice. I think, we live right now in a very strict black or white society. It's like either you're wrong or you're right. And I think right now we need to find some gray. I won't, you know, stop listening to you because you don't agree with me. I won't stop listening to you because you have a different opinion. We need to figure out how to compromise in our government so that all of us can win. Government is a public office. You're here to serve.
My guest is actor Anthony Mackie. He stars as Martin Luther King Jr. in the HBO movie All the Way. It premieres on the cable network tomorrow. So I wonder how difficult it was. What was the challenge like for you to shut some of this out while you were filming this? And I ask that because there's some discord there. You're talking about a period in history in which the Voting Rights Act was one of the major achievements to Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement. But you're living in a time in which you have John Lewis railing against the weakening of the Voting Rights Act. You have some of the very civil rights leaders that appear in movies like this and Selma talking about how we have lost the progress they earned. How do you keep that part, the modern day reality, shut out from your look at history?
Well, you can't keep the modern day part out. I would say everything that's going on in politics now, when we were shooting this movie, fueled my passion and my desire to tell this story. It fueled me to get the words, the voice, the actions of Dr. King out there so we don't forget. America is a country that treats history just that, just as that, history. And I think when you look at everything that, you know, John Lewis and Dr. King and Ralph Abernathy and all these men and women achieved, you can't forget that. You can't say thanks, but we're going to move on from that. No, we have to make that a part of the conversation and a part of our daily society. It's interesting when you think about it, because just a year and a half ago, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. I mean, destroyed everything that they worked for. And now it's what they're doing is they're rezoning and repopulating voting brackets so they can quarantine the people into certain areas that are going to vote a certain way. So we can't, if we forget our history, then how do we move into the future?
So I wanted to ask you, Marvel is a little bit of an outlier in terms of diversity in casting. I mean, there was one moment in Civil War where I was looking on screen and you've got the Black Panther and Don Cheadle and we've got you. But that's an exception. And so for a long time, we heard from actors and people in the business that they didn't want to play slaves anymore. They didn't want every Black actor to be playing a servant or butler or slave. And now there's a little bit of rumbling that they fear Hollywood is solving the diversity problem by going back to historic characters. And I wonder how you feel about this, about reaching back in history instead of casting what would be just a normal role that could go to anyone, instead of putting an African-American actor in a role like that, a rom-com.
Well, I think, you know, we're in a place now where with 12 Years a Slave doing so well, they're going to make more movies that are in television shows that are themed in that same vein. I think with Marvel, which is so great and I'm so proud to be a part of, Marvel has always had an open mind as far as what their characters look like. I mean, you don't forget Nick Fury in the comic book was written as a white man.
Oh, yeah, very white.
And they cast Sam Jackson. So this isn't something new for Marvel. It isn't, a scheme to get more people to watch the movies. Kevin Feige has surrounded himself with a very diverse group of people, and because of that, he gets a feel, an understanding of color from every aspect of culture. And I think we're very lucky. If you look at Marcus and McFeely, who write the movies, if you look at the Russo brothers, who direct the movies, you couldn't have more understanding and open-minded people in a room together to make a film. It's impossible. There's no way to get more open-minded people. And I think it reflects in the movies. I think, I'm a firm believer in creating content. Film is still a business. And if you show them where you can make money, they will finance your movie. Tyler Perry does not have a problem. Oprah does not have a problem. Denzel does not have a problem. Will Smith does not have a problem getting their movies financed. That's because they're bankable names. So what we need to do is become bankable names.
That is Anthony Mackie. He plays Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the HBO biopic All the Way. It premieres this Saturday. Anthony, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. This week, the Department of Education released a nationwide mandate about the treatment of transgender youth. Schools who deny transgender students access to bathrooms, locker rooms, and other facilities could face lawsuits or lose federal funding. Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Eric Sturgis joins us now. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
Can you just explain what is in this mandate from the Department of Education and what it means?
Sure. The mandate, federal officials said they had been working on for several months beforehand. It says that transgender students should be allowed to use restrooms, locker rooms, and other facilities that fit their gender identity. It does also say that schools can make what they describe as individual user options for students, for all students who seek such privacy, or another term that's been used is gender neutral facilities.
I understand there's an option for schools that could afford it to have bathrooms set aside.
Correct. Yes, in the case of one school like Cobb County and Walton High School, they have what they call a gender neutral facility that students can use, because at that school there is a transgender student that we previously interviewed. heiress Sage Lovell, who has that accommodation available to her.
Now, one of the criticisms of policies like this has been that any student at any point could decide, well, today my gender identity is male, yesterday it was female, and so I'm going to go into a different bathroom. What guidance do schools get, if any, on how to identify transgender youth and when that distinction is made?
Well, the terminology, the guidelines in the directive, is that students should be, as they say, a transgender male is someone who identifies as male but was assigned the sex of female at birth, while a transgender female is someone who identifies as a female but was assigned the sex of a male at birth. So in those cases, they're relying upon what the student identifies himself or herself to be. And the federal government is asking schools just to rely upon what the student identifies with and allowing them to use whatever facilities that they feel best fit that identity.
The punishment here, one of them that's threatened, is losing federal funding. How does that work? What does a school have to do or not do to be in danger of losing funds from the government?
In that instance, if the school has to, or the school district who's saying, well, we are not going to abide by these federal guidelines, and then, under the federal's Title IX Act, the federal government could act by taking measures such as removing their funding. Georgia receives about $2 billion a year in federal funding. The numbers for each school district in Georgia vary. There are 181 school districts in Georgia, so the numbers do vary there. But, there are some people in Georgia who are asking the state to, or their school district, to consider that. I know there have been some lawmakers nationwide, like the lieutenant governor of Texas, who has suggested that Texas forego that federal funding.
And look, here in Georgia, it's already caused a problem. We have some relatively prominent state politicians who said they're going to fight this to the very end. What does that mean as far as you understand it? Do we expect either the state of Georgia or some individual school districts to file suit?
It's a possibility. I know that there have been discussions right now among state leaders, and right now the governor has asked the superintendent, Richard Woods, to take a closer look at the policy and to issue guidance to school districts about what to do about this directive. There haven't been any full-scale discussions as yet, as we're aware of, about any legal action that may take place. But right now, I think there is a lot of discussion going on amongst school districts because they're still trying to get a better understanding of what these guidelines are and how they would have to adhere to it if they decide to do so.
Have there been issues in Georgia schools in the past with transgender students in bathrooms? The issues that people keep saying are a danger, issues of sexual assault, issues of inappropriate conduct. Has that come up?
We are aware of very little of that discussion or those types of issues. As I mentioned, when the directive was first issued on Friday, we did interview a student in Cobb County and asked about her experiences. And she said in one instance, she was directed to go to a men's room, and she said she felt very uncomfortable there and even cried there. But in general, the school has set aside a gender-neutral facility that she can use. And so she said in general she's had very few issues, but that was one issue that she did cite.
Does this mandate go into effect immediately? I know a lot of schools are letting out for the summer, but is it basically in effect now?
Well, it is in effect, and it is considered a directive and not necessarily a law. But as we had discussed, there is a danger of losing that federal funding. But right now it is considered the federal government's policy, and schools should adhere to it.
The difference being that a law has to be passed by Congress and then signed by the president. This is a directive that came from the Department of Education, which oversees all the schools, which means it's still a rule. It's just not a law. But, Eric, you've been reporting on this issue at least for a little while. You're not expecting it to go away.
Yes, there are several school districts that are having discussions about this. There is a Tea Party group who has been asking their supporters to reach out to school board members, in particular in Gwinnett County, to raise awareness and ask questions about this directive, how they will adhere to it, if they will, and should they adhere to it.
Okay, Eric Sturgis is an education reporter for the AJC. Eric, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
I am standing, staring.
You know what? It's been a long week, and we talked about the reasons why Black people tip less this week, what it was like for millions of families who moved south from the Rust Belt, how the WNBA can maybe reinvent itself. Now it's time to sit back, relax, and celebrate Friday. Let's head into the break room.
When it comes to divorce, humans may fight like cats and dogs, but more and more, they're fighting about cats and dogs.
I noticed you also circled a bunch of things on our ticket. Why did you do that?
Because otherwise, the line moves too quickly. You see, the whole thing we're going for here at the TSA is a sort of bored fascism.
Jack, I want you to pay close attention to the following over-the-top eye roll. Oh, brother.
Joining us in the break room, Bea Nguyen, Executive Director of Athena's Warehouse, which is a nonprofit in Atlanta. Good morning, Bea.
Good morning, Celeste.
Greg Williams, host of the radio show Greg's List. Hi, Greg.
Good to see you again.
Roxanne Donovan is Associate Professor of Psychology and Interdisciplinary Studies at Kennesaw State University. Good to see you, Roxanne.
Morning.
And Chuck Reese, editor of The Bitter Southerner. In the last day of the membership campaign, yes?
We are announcing this morning we're extending it until Sunday.
Always a good cause to support great writing and reporting in the South at the Bitter Southern.
Thank you.
In any case, let's talk about some things about which we may not agree, shall we? We just heard about the guidelines that the U.S. Department of Education has sent to public schools on how they need to handle bathroom facilities and any shared facilities in schools. That letter actually threatens to pull federal funds if schools do not accommodate transgender students. So hundreds of people in Fannin County in North Georgia marched to the school board there to protest. And House Speaker David Ralston says the federal government is overreaching its authority. What do we think about this? Federal overreach?
As usual, federal overreach. But I got an easy solution for it. Let's have a men's room, women's room, and a Miss Doubtfire room. I think that cures everything.
I don't like that response, primarily because I think we need to do some education on transgender. And as we're evolving as a society and kids and people are becoming more comfortable about gender identity, there's discomfort that comes up as well. And so when I hear something like a Mrs. Doubtfire room, it just does not sit well with me. And I know we're supposed to be talking about federal overreach, but a lot of what we should also be talking about is education and exposure in places where people can feel safe and not threatened. And I think primarily a lot of it is about the fear, and we need to address the fear along with other things.
Right.
I grew up in North Georgia, just south of Fannin County. Went to high school with Speaker Ralston's little brother.
Did you?
I did. I know Speaker Ralston since I was knee-high,
yeah,
you know.
In knickers.
And I think he's completely wrong about this. I mean, we have to evolve our view of the way we look at gender in this society. You know, for you to say something like a Mrs. Doubtfire room and sort of make a joke of people's gender, to a lot of people, is just as insulting as if you had wanted, you know, if you were endorsing white and colored signs over the restaurant.
Come on now.
No. I mean, there's no come on now on that. I just don't.
This is an example
that
of this,
people
this overly political correct world that we live in now. I mean, you
it's
know,
not
it was,
about political correctness. It's about
that's
people's
exactly
ideas.
About
well,
political correctness.
Well, before we
correct.
Get into an argument, it's nice to hear disagreement. Roxanne, can we make you the peacemaker? Or?
Look, if it's overreach, I'm thankful for it, right? Because the federal government has had to step in multiple times in the name of justice. Think marriage equality, think civil rights, think gender equality. And this is one of those times where it's just and needed. And if it brings us a little closer to acknowledging the humanity and dignity of trans folks, then I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to something which never makes people fight in the South, college sports.
uh-huh. This is a contentious morning already.
Yeah, I guess so.
The fights are more good-natured, though.
Contention is totally fine because we're smart and polite about it.
Yes, we are.
Georgia school officials want schools to spend less money on sports. Well, specific kinds of money. The University System of Georgia has approved a new rule that caps how much tuition money schools can use to pay for their sports program. Not a problem at Tech and UGA, right? Because they have tons of alumni dollars coming in. But at schools like Georgia State, they might have trouble paying for their football program because they do use a sizable amount of tuition money and those fees, the student fees, to pay for sports which are not profitable. So do we support this change or not?
I'm all for it. I mean, I think about the system and how difficult it is for students to get the type of education they need because full-time faculty to student ratios are so high because it's hard to get all the resources. And students who want to go to college can't, and they need scholarships. So if there's a way to cap things that are more recreational and don't bring money into the university and then move that money, here's the key, move the money to things that improve education and access to education, that is a good thing.
Okay, anyone want to argue that sports are more than just recreational?
Well, I actually would do that. I mean, I think that, you know, I certainly learned things by playing sports when I was a young person. Now, certainly I didn't play at the college level, but that, you know, still stick with me to this day about teamwork and things like that.
So does that mean you would support spending tuition dollars to support?
Not necessarily. I think, you know, the thing is, it's not really a binary question. It's, you know, it's all about the funding formula allocation and how people of goodwill can come together on that and figure out, okay, this is the right amount of money to go here. And this is the
I
right
feel like V has something to say because her arms are crossed.
Oh, no, I don't. I'm just thinking, I'm going to just say, I'm going to agree with everything Chuck says for the rest of the morning.
No. We do need some
dangerous.
Greg, what do you think?
I mean, I think that that team sports have certainly built a generation of camaraderie. And a lot of times you'll see these companies go on team building events. And I see a lot of similarities in that and a lot of parallels between,
But that's about the value of sports. That's not about whether or not they should be able to use tuition money to support sports.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that they should be able to because it's an important part of a program. It can build school spirit. A lot of attendance of some of these games can build rapport amongst students. Remember pep rallies, stuff
like
that?
Yeah, I do. So I was a cheerleader. In college.
I thought that was an important part of high school and college for me. So.
Okay, I know that our listeners have opinions about that, and you know how to reach us on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can go to Facebook. Okay, so
I've already been reached on Twitter by somebody.
I bet you have.
Thank you, Robbie.
remember Anthony Weiner? hopefully, since then, politicians have learned their lesson about sharing, oversharing on social media.
It was revealed that Anthony Weiner sent nude pictures of himself to this woman using a Carlos Danger Yahoo email address. His wife was shocked. She was like, "You still use Yahoo?"
Okay, but Mike Webb, a candidate who's running for Congress in Virginia, is taking some heat for... He took a screenshot of his desktop, and then he posted it on Facebook, and he forgot to close the multiple pornography site tabs that he had open before he shared that screenshot. He first deleted the post, then he reposted it saying he has, quote, nothing to hide. So I wonder here if he has a point. I mean, look, we all know the percentage of people that watch porn online. If we know that most people do it, why should we be concerned if a politician does?
Well, all I got to say is, you know, if you're going to do anything on your browser that you wouldn't want people to look at over your shoulder, there's a little thing in Google Chrome that says go incognito, and it gives you a new window, and the tabs aren't there with everything else.
That makes it sound like you're less worried that he's watching porn, but that he's not smart enough to hide it.
I have the same concern.
Yeah,
I don't
much.
Care that he's watching porn, honestly. I really don't care. I think if that's what he wants to do in his own time, it's fine. But why isn't he smart enough to be able to hide it? That is my concern. And I really think, you know, it applies to anything we're doing. There are a lot of things that we do that many people do outside of our workspace. And I'm not going to advertise it because I'm a smart person.
Okay. So you think he's dumb. Greg?
Yes.
Roxanne?
Yeah, it's one of the things. I mean, if you get caught, you're dumb. But so, you know, that's my thing.
Well, I know porn is a part of our culture and it's not going away. But mainstream porn is pretty degrading to women. It's violence toward women. And I don't know, a politician watching it and then being dumb enough to post it, I have major problems about that as a woman. And if I was part of his constituency, I don't know. know. I'd take a minute before, maybe an hour, maybe a day, maybe a year before ever considering voting for him.
Sounds like without ever. A doubt, he would have lost my vote. Yeah.
He might win some votes in some areas.
Yeah, so you got that right.
All right, my guests in the break room, Roxanne Donovan of Kennesaw State, Greg Williams of the show Greg's List, B. Wynn of Athena's Warehouse, and Chuck Reese, editor of The Bitter Southerner. It is Friday. We are in the break room. You can join the conversation on Twitter at OSD Talk. Some people already have. We want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters. As always, they donate the coffee that fuels our break room guests this morning. They are online at savannahcoffee.com, and they're breaking the stereotype of public radio having awful tasting coffee, for which we thank them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so have you ever caught yourself having to physically stop yourself from rolling your eyes?
Jack, I want you to pay close attention to the following over-the-top eye roll. Oh, brother.
Okay, a study out of the University of Washington found small behaviors like rolling your eyes are the number one predictor of divorce. Others include being sarcastic and name-calling. And we wondered if you believe in these stats. Have you rolled your eyes at anybody recently?
I've always thought that strip clubs and Match.com were the leading causes of divorce, but eye-rolling. My wife is from Ecuador, so she speaks to me in Spanish sometimes. I may do an eye roll every now and then.
Oh, because you don't understand what
yes.
she's saying.
And then I look it up later, and I'm like,
and
wow.
And you said before that she talks fast yes. when she's fired up.
Muy rápido.
Yeah. Anybody else about eye rolling? Wait. We have an actual psychology professor here, so.
Oh, yes. God. I've rolled my eyes in the last 5 minutes. So as a social scientist, I've got to believe the research generally, right? But as a spouse and an admitted eye roller, I'm hoping it doesn't apply to me. But I think there's a distance between eye rolling and name calling. And I might be eye rolling to keep myself from name calling. But I can see that the cluster of behaviors. Okay, I'm trying to totally justify.
You are totally justified. I actually heard
somebody
said, well, I'll call him a jerk, but I'd never roll my eyes. What do you think, B?
You know, I don't actually know if I roll my eyes consciously. I really try not to, but I am very expressive. I throw my hands up in the air a lot. You can tell just verbally and physically what I mean when I say it. So I probably don't really roll my eyes a lot, but I definitely express how I feel. So there's no hiding that.
Well, all I know is that, you know, as the most divorced person in this room.
It's true.
In my first two marriages, I definitely noticed in my own behavior that when I caught myself rolling my eyes, we were already heading down a bad road. Mm. Now, the good news is I don't roll my eyes at my current wife.
Because you got it right.
I got it right this time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there you go. Okay. Speaking of eye rolling, let's talk about families and politics. We know that you're supposed to avoid it over dinner, right? Talking about politics. But we wonder if you think the conversations could actually tear families apart. A woman in Australia recently severed ties with her mother completely when she found out that her mother is an avid Trump supporter. It wasn't just that. She found social media postings her mother had written in which her mom used, quote, hateful memes, ugly language, and appearance-based attacks targeted at Hillary Clinton. So is there a politician or political issue that could divide you from your family? What would you sever family ties over? We asked this question to our listeners, by the way, and Alan Aitanagar from Decatur said this.
While I don't know anyone who's admitted that they support Trump, if they did, I believe I might just disown them. But if any of my friends or family came out as a Bernie or bust person, then I would absolutely cut them out. That attitude comes from a place of white privilege and shows a complete lack of concern for the well-being of those people who would suffer most under a Trump presidency.
Interesting, right? Anybody here think there's a politician or issue that you would sever ties over?
I don't know. I've discovered in my life, and I used to work in politics, and I'm fairly opinionated. But
you're kidding me.
Yeah. but you know, I mean, if I can't sit across a table and be in a friendly relationship with somebody who has different political points of view than me, there's a much deeper problem.
I think you're sitting across from someone who has different political views from
you. Well,
yeah,
and the thing about it is we can disagree vehemently about one thing, and we can, you know, shake hands and talk about something else and get along just fine.
And I'm sure there's plenty of issues that we'd agree on. I like to look at a quote from Thomas Jefferson. I never considered a difference of opinion in politics, in religion, in philosophy as cause for withdrawing from a friend. So I think that's a very formative quote for people. And I think that we also need to get a little over this political correctness. I mean, my off-color joke at the beginning, I don't think was a cause that I hate the LGBT community. So let's get over ourselves and some of this self-righteousness that
you're raising your hand, but it's radio, so people can't see that.
Celeste, can you please call on me right now?
Go ahead.
I grew up with two very conservative Republican parents, and I love them very much. We don't talk about politics a lot. And I am actually doing something for the first time in my life. I am dating a Republican, and I never thought I would be in that space ever. You know, what I learned that is what I care about is shared values and common values and finding that place. And I care about intentions and why people believe the things that they believe. So I don't think that it's a good enough reason to sever ties. However, I do still take problem with the Mrs. Doubtfire comment. I don't think it's political correctness, and I want to say that.
Okay, before we return, I totally get everyone has strong opinions. That's why you're here, right? Because you have strong opinions. But let's move on. And Roxanne, the thing I wanted to ask you, and it seems to me like the thing that really bothered her was seeing her mother's hatred posted publicly. And that seems to have been what caused her to sever ties. She didn't want to see her mom saying these awful things about other people.
And I think it's one thing to disagree, and it's another thing to have to bear witness to someone's public discriminatory act. So I can understand her difficulty. I mean, in my mind, friends you choose, family, you know, you get. And it might be helpful, instead of severing ties, to kind of talk with her mom about the pain that she felt when she read these things.
Yeah.
And the impact that that might have on people like her, meaning her daughter, and also the people that she's tweeting about or writing about on Facebook.
We got a tweet from Sam Burnham who says, my mother was furious when I didn't vote Romney in 2012, but she got past it. And David Thompson says, I would gladly trade a few eye rolls for the current discourse in the presidential campaign. You can reach out to us at OST Talk. We are in the break room. My guests are Roxanne Donovan of Kennesaw State, Chuck Reese of The Bitter Southerner, Greg Williams of the show Greg's List, and B. Wynn of Athena's Warehouse. Okay, so this is one that I actually feel personally, but child custody battles absolutely can get very ugly when there's a divorce. But I am one of those people that would be willing to take legal action to keep my pet.
The animal court is now in session.
Is that what he thinks of your testimony?
I guess.
Pets are increasingly the subject of some pretty bitter divorce battles. Custody of that furry kid often has to be settled by a judge. So let's just ask, if it came down to it, who in your family would get the dog or cat? Would you fight for pet custody? I've already admitted I would.
Yeah, I certainly would. I have two senior dogs, though, so I don't think they'd really be part of the negotiations if between me and the wife. So.
Oh, because they're older?
And just hard to take care of, and the cute furry animals that so many people want these days.
Oh, B, would you fight?
Oh, so I'm a bad person to ask about this because I actually pushed one of my pets onto my mom. Mm. I was like, please take him. Please take him.
So the answer to that is no.
But
you would not.
I still have my 13-year-old, very cranky, very uncharming poodle, and I wouldn't give him up.
If my eye rolling leads to divorce, then yes, I'm fighting. I'm fighting for my pets all the way.
But she wouldn't name call. Chuck?
I'll just talk about my experience. In both my divorces, there were pets involved, and I don't know, somehow in both cases it seemed to sort of work itself out, you know, because one was closer to, you know, Ruby.
Oh,
then,
interesting. You're letting the pet decide who they like better.
Yeah, kind of. That's what we did in both cases, and it worked out.
Interesting.
All right.
I would put milk bones in my pocket.
That's what you're saying. There's a way to bribe the decision makers on that, isn't it?
All right. So let's talk about traveling. If you thought the lines at the DMV were long,
this is ridiculous.
Go wait in the appointment line. Then.
I don't want to wait. I've got a job. I don't have all day. I can't say this.
You're going to have to take that somewhere else.
Hard.
All right. You know what? I'm on break.
Officials at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport are warning travelers to arrive 2 to 3 hours early if they want to make their flights. That's because the South Security Checkpoint is closed for upgrades. It closed nearly 2 weeks ago. It will remain closed for some time. So at what point is the airport slower than driving?
Nashville.
That's it?
It depends if you have to use I-75. If you have to use I-75, the airport is always going to be faster.
I just feel like if I were traveling to Washington, D.C., I might just drive.
That's 12 hours.
That's a pretty long drive. Yeah. I just did it recently.
But think about the time it takes to get through all the deals with the TSA, the time
parking.
It takes to get on board.
Yeah, D.C. is 560 miles, so it's a good 10 to 12 hours, depending on which way you go, right?
But at least you feel more in control.
Oh, my gosh, B's going to tell us
a trick. Okay, but then this is not going to work because I'm telling everyone. The trick is to get dropped off at International and go through that security. It's much shorter and faster.
That is a good trick.
Oh, and then you just ride the train.
Don't use that trick, guys, this weekend or next weekend because I'm flying out.
You know there's a lot of people listening right now, right?
I know.
What the heck were you thinking?
I just revealed it.
Okay. Homeland Security actually this morning announced that they think the lines would be shorter if the airlines would stop charging people for baggage because then they wouldn't have to be checking everyone's luggage at the...
Because that's the reason.
The carry-on baggage has gotten huge now. I mean, you see people lugging around, things that are probably 40 or 50 pounds, and
ridiculous.
TSA has to go through that. Yeah, I think that has been a huge issue. And with oil prices down so much, let's get the free bags back, airlines.
Okay, there you heard that, Delta. You're located here. Okay, Georgia's unemployment numbers are up, but that doesn't mean our wages are up. They're not, in fact. A new report from the University of California, Berkeley, found nearly half of our state's factory workers are on government assistance. The author of the study says, quote, manufacturing has long been thought of as providing high-paying middle-class work, but the reality is the production jobs are increasingly coming to resemble fast food or Walmart jobs, end quote. Now, the authors say a lot of the blame is on the use of temp workers. And I'm wondering, is this acceptable? Is this just kind of part of the way we... Because our state fights really hard to get these particular kind of jobs.
I would imagine it's also based on automation now. So it's... If I used to work up in Dalton and some of the carpet mills up there, basically they have humans that watch a computer do a lot of the work. And at some point, you don't need to have... That high of a wage for that kind of job. Eventually, when we're in a more of a service-oriented economy now, so the production side of things, we're going to be competing with in the Mexicos and the Chinas and Vietnam and Indias of the world where they can produce things for much cheaper on a wage basis. So I think that it's going to continue to drive down manufacturing wages in this country.
But should I be supplementing their income as a taxpayer?
Well, that's a really... difficult question, and we all know and acknowledge that income inequality has become a huge problem.
I think Atlanta may still be number one for income inequality.
Yeah, and but the thing about it is I spent a lot of my career reporting on business, and I think so much of it has to do with the values of the people who run any individual business.
Mm-hmm.
We did a story not long ago about the Lodge cast iron factory.
Oh, that was a great piece.
Up over the state line in Tennessee. Manufacturing company that's been there for, almost a century. And, the way they're able to treat their workers right is basically because they've made the decision not to do business with Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what's driving,
it's profit
stuff
margins.
If you're a publicly held company, you become a slave to the quarterly guidance you have to give the Wall Street analysts. And it makes it very difficult for you to make long-term decisions if it's going to shave your earnings by a few pennies a share. And... It's hugely problematic, and it's something that needs to be looked at a deep level, but it's way above my head.
Well, since we're talking about profit margins, let's talk about the Falcons. The Falcons owner, Arthur Blank, announced this week there's going to be a fan-first menu. $2 hot dogs, $3 nachos, $5 beers. Those prices will be the cheapest concessions in the NFL. On Twitter, we asked, would those prices be enough to get you to a Falcons game? And Elizabeth Desnoyer, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, just tweeted back, Nope. So what about you guys? Cheap concessions more likely to get you to the game?
No, but a winning program would. But we were talking off air, the $2 refills on soda, for me, that is a huge boon, because that's going to make the flask of Jack Daniels I bring in a little bit bigger, and I won't be having to subsidize the Jack Daniels with $8 sodas.
And the Jack Daniels might make you enjoy the game more as we lose. B?
Are the tickets cheaper? Because I care about that more than the hot dogs.
I don't think so.
Okay, well.
Roxanne?
B makes a good point. If the tickets were cheaper, I mean, I have two kids, and when we go to a game, it is so expensive. Mm-hmm. We are dropping over $100.
Yeah, parking is like $25.
Between parking, the tickets, and then, of course, they get there and they want to eat all this junk. And so, of course.
And then you roll your eyes at them.
I'm rolling my eyes while I'm digging into my wallet. So, I mean, it would be very nice if you have the privilege to shell out the money to go to these games, that you then don't have to cough up another $100 or so to feed yourself. So I actually think it's a good thing. Reducing ticket prices would be a better thing.
Chuck, we got a minute left. What do you think?
It's hard for me to afford going to a professional sports event of any kind because the ticket prices have gotten so high. You know, this is just me. I'd rather save my money for when Sturgill Simpson comes to town or run
well,
the Jewel show.
So he'll spend the money on a concert. We want to hear from you as well. Is a $2 hot dog enough to get you to a Falcons game? Does that make the dividing line for you? You know how to reach us. We're on Twitter at OSD Talk. We're on Facebook as well. We're out of time in the break room today. I want to say thank you to all the guests. B. Wynn is executive director of Athena's Warehouse, which is a nonprofit to empower teenage girls. Greg Williams hosts the conservative radio show Greg's List. Roxanne Donovan is associate professor of psychology and interdisciplinary studies at Kennesaw State University. And Chuck Reese, editor of The Bitter Southerner. That's our show for today. But again, would you go to a Falcons game with the dividing line, the decision maker be the price of those $3 nachos? Let us know. Call us at 404-500-9457. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it. Good seeing you guys.
Have a good weekend. For today and the week, it's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great weekend.